Have you ever stared at your reflection and wondered where your life went wrong? That's exactly where Isadora Bentley finds herself on the eve of her 30th birthday, contemplating her final meal in a Stop & Shop parking lot. Despite her academic brilliance and PhD-level research skills, Isadora's life has become a study in isolation, a going-nowhere job, no meaningful connections, and a Sir David Attenborough-narrated inner monologue that's her only companion. It's no wonder Courtney Walsh's The Happy Life of Isadora Bentley resonated so deeply with readers, shooting to the top of bestseller lists and earning praise from celebrities like Reese Witherspoon, who called it a masterclass in finding joy in life's smallest moments. This novel about a socially awkward researcher's systematic approach to happiness has sparked book clubs nationwide to create their own happiness experiments, proving that sometimes the most scientific approach to emotion yields the most heartfelt results. Isadora Bentley's life is defined by control, measurement, and isolation. Working in Chicago University's Behavioral and Social Sciences Research Lab, she finds comfort in her lemony-scented former janitor's closet office, where problems have solutions and human interaction is minimal. The space, barely large enough for her desk and filing cabinet, has become her sanctuary, a place where she can sort data without the messiness of human emotions intruding. Her boss, Gary, not to be confused with her office succulent of the same name, which she waters precisely every Wednesday at 2 p.m., regularly chastises her for not showing interest in students' work, highlighting her social shortcomings as a research leader. His attempts to draw her into department meetings and student consultations are met with carefully crafted excuses and meticulously documented schedule conflicts. When Isadora impulsively purchases a magazine, her first non-academic reading material in months, with an article titled 31 Ways to Be Happy Today by Dr. Grace Monroe, she approaches it like any good scientist would, with skepticism and methodology. She decides to conduct an experiment to disprove it, treating happiness like a research project, with herself as the reluctant test subject. Her approach is clinical, detached, and perfectly aligned with how she's navigated her entire life, through observation rather than participation. She creates spreadsheets, establishes control variables, and designs measurement matrices for each happiness intervention suggested in the article. What makes Isadora's journey so compelling is her genuine belief that happiness is something that happens to other people, a variable she hasn't been able to isolate in her own equation. She watches her colleagues laugh over lunch breaks, observes students celebrating successful experiments, and catalogs these moments of joy with the detachment of a naturalist studying an exotic species. Her scientific mind becomes both her greatest asset and her most significant obstacle, as she meticulously documents each attempt at happiness while simultaneously holding herself at an emotional distance from the results. She treats her own emotions like data points, graphing her responses to everything from random acts of kindness to morning meditation sessions. The brilliance of this setup lies in how it mirrors our own tendency to overthink happiness, to analyze rather than experience it. Through Isadora's methodical approach to joy, we see reflected our modern obsession with quantifying and optimizing every aspect of our lives. How many of us have found ourselves standing outside our own lives, clipboard in hand, wondering why joy seems so accessible to others yet remains elusive to us? Isadora's experiment becomes a mirror for our own attempts to schedule, measure, and control our way to contentment, complete with hypothesis testing, margin of error calculations, and carefully controlled variables that ultimately prove impossible to maintain in the messy laboratory of real life. Isadora's first experiment, Smile More, proves surprisingly difficult, revealing both her social awkwardness and determination. After spending hours practicing smiles in the bathroom mirror, meticulously categorizing them as serial killer for too much teeth, politician for its artificial warmth, and constipated for its obvious strain, she forces herself to venture into the crowded university cafeteria despite her mounting anxiety. Her initial attempt to smile at a group of university baseball players fails spectacularly. One athlete asks if she's having a medical emergency, while another suggests she might be plotting their demise. Mortified, she retreats to a bench in the university's quad to collect herself and document this first failed attempt. While recording her observations, she notices an elderly man sitting across from her, feeding pigeons and seemingly content in his solitude. Something about his peaceful demeanor calms her racing thoughts. Gathering what remains of her courage, she attempts one final smile for the day, this time softer, less rehearsed. The elderly man smiles back warmly, and something unexpected stirs inside her, a sensation she later describes as a peculiar warmth, like drinking hot chocolate on a cold day. When he approaches and introduces himself as Marty, they share a genuine conversation about his late wife Shirley, whom he met in that exact spot 57 years ago while she was reading Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. For the first time, Isadora notes in her research journal, I found myself engaged in human connection rather than data collection. The variables became irrelevant, the methodology forgotten. This unfamiliar flutter in her chest might actually be happiness, or perhaps just indigestion from her questionable cafeteria lunch. She finds herself hoping it's the former. What's remarkable about this scene is how it establishes the novel's central premise. Happiness isn't found in isolation, but in genuine human connection. Marty becomes Isadora's first real friend in years, serving as a bridge between her controlled, isolated existence and a world of messy, unpredictable human relationships. Their friendship develops organically through weekly meetings on their bench, with Marty filling conversations with stories about his life as a former literature professor, his marriage to Shirley, and his observations about the changing university landscape, all without requiring Isadora's constant input, relieving the pressure she typically feels to eliminate silence. This relationship becomes a safe testing ground for Isadora, a low-risk environment where she can practice vulnerability without the threat of romantic rejection or professional consequences. Through their weekly conversations, Marty gently challenges her scientific approach to happiness, sharing wisdom through stories rather than statistics. Through Marty, we see the first cracks in Isadora's carefully constructed walls, allowing light to filter into her hermetically sealed existence. His presence serves as a catalyst for her transformation, showing her that meaningful connections can't be reduced to variables in an experiment. They must be experienced, felt, and sometimes simply allowed to unfold naturally. Just as Isadora begins to find comfort in her controlled experiment, a disruptive variable appears in the form of Dr. Cal Baxter, a tall, bearded professor in a tweed blazer who literally crashes into her world. When Gary assigns her to help organize Cal's book research, Isadora panics and protests, insisting she works better alone. Her resistance stems from a deeper wound. One we'll discover later involves another professor named Alex who betrayed her trust. Despite her mortifying first impression, Cal overhears her complaining about lazy professors taking credit for others' work. He persists in reaching out, requesting to meet for coffee to discuss the project. Their initial interactions are a masterclass in awkward exchanges, from accidentally swapping coffee cups, creating what her third-grade mind considers an intimate cup kiss, to blurting out a compliment about his straight teeth. Cal's research focus proves particularly unsettling to Isadora. His book isn't about demonizing technology, but exploring how it affects human connections. When he suggests that humans fundamentally need each other for happiness, directly contradicting Isadora's personal philosophy, she grows visibly uncomfortable, especially when he asks if she considers herself lonely. What makes Cal such an effective character is how he challenges Isadora's core beliefs without attempting to change her. He sees value in her research, defends her work to others, and most importantly, sees her, not just the awkward exterior, but the brilliant, wounded person beneath. Their connection develops through shared appreciation for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, real pencils over mechanical ones, and the way Cal never seems put off by Isadora's social fumbling. Through Cal, Walsh explores how romantic connection differs from friendship. While Marty offers Isadora unconditional acceptance without expectation, Cal represents risk, the possibility of both profound joy and devastating heartbreak. His presence forces Isadora to confront whether her isolation is a choice or a prison she's built for herself. As Isadora's experiment progresses, her carefully controlled study group unexpectedly expands. A crash outside her apartment introduces her to Darby and her diaper-clad toddler Diego, part of a family of six with four D-named children. Despite Isadora's reluctance, Darby pulls her into a yoga class and subsequently into her vibrant social circle. The yoga studio scene brilliantly parallels Isadora's middle school trauma when her only friend Mia abandoned her for a new social group. In that painful memory, Isadora had bought Mia a best friend's split charm necklace for her birthday, only to be publicly humiliated when Mia cruelly rejected her, claiming she was only friends with Isadora because her mother made her. The trauma culminated with Isadora flushing her half of the necklace down a toilet, while her mother later dismissed her pain, telling her she should try harder to fit in. In stark contrast to this memory, Darby unexpectedly introduces Isadora to her yoga friends Meg and Stacy, who warmly welcome her. This simple act of inclusion begins healing a wound Isadora has carried since childhood, the belief that she is fundamentally unwelcome in social settings. The most touching relationship develops between Isadora and Delilah, Darby's bookish 10-year-old daughter, who feels like an outsider among her peers. When Delilah reveals her classmates call her Delilah Pigstyla, Isadora shares that she was called Isadorcus, or sometimes Isadorcus Maximus. Their connection triggers a forgotten memory for Isadora, of herself at 10, praying for a friend who would understand her, realizing Delilah is the answer to that prayer just years late. Through these expanding relationships, Isadora's experiment transforms from a solitary pursuit to a community effort. Marty becomes her official research partner, while Darby, her children, and eventually Cal all participate in various happiness steps. What began as a controlled experiment becomes beautifully uncontrolled, messy, unpredictable, and infinitely more meaningful than Isadora's original design. As Isadora progresses through Dr. Monroe's happiness steps, her approach gradually shifts from skepticism to genuine engagement. Each step challenges her comfort zone in different ways. For exercise regularly, she endures painful yoga classes with Darby, discovering that while she hates the poses, she loves the community. The instructor, Samira, tells her she has as much right to exist in this world as everyone else, words that give Isadora an unexpected surge of confidence. Decluttering her apartment provides immediate satisfaction, teaching her that small environmental changes can impact her mental state. When she follows this by organizing Cal's research papers, she discovers personal dimensions to his work, noting a sticky note with Sasha written on it that hints at deeper motivations. Breathe deeply becomes a communal activity when her separate social worlds collide. Marty, Darby, and her children all practicing together in the university courtyard. This simple act creates an unexpected moment of connection when Cal joins them and mouths, "Close your eyes," to Isadora, giving her the unfamiliar feeling of sharing an inside joke. Spend time with animals transforms into a joyful afternoon when Cal arrives with 8 shelter dogs, immediately lifting Marty's spirits on his wedding anniversary without Shirley. Watching the fluffy gray dog named Hank roll over for belly rubs in Cal's lap, Isadora decides to stop overthinking and simply feel whatever she feels. Get out in the sun becomes a liberating drive in a borrowed 1965 Ford Mustang convertible, followed by kite flying in a deserted small-town park. Despite Isadora's initial concerns about the physics of kite flying and potential embarrassment, she eventually lets go of her need to control everything, finding unexpected joy in surrendering to the wind. Spread encouragement to those around you sees Isadora writing encouraging notes on colored paper to hide around campus during finals week. Watching a student find one of her notes, reading it multiple times before tucking it into her textbook, makes Isadora reflect on whether she could be a light in the world instead of hiding away. Through these experiences, Isadora discovers that happiness isn't found in isolation or perfect execution, but in the messy process of engaging with life. The scientific framework she initially created becomes less about proving or disproving a hypothesis and more about giving herself permission to experience emotions she's long suppressed. As Isadora's relationship with Cal deepens, her unresolved trauma threatens to derail her progress. We learn that her ex, Alex, also a professor, had flattered her intelligence, promised equal credit on a publication, and pursued her romantically. For the first time, Isadora felt seen and wanted, even sharing her excitement with her mother. After months of tireless research and growing intimacy, the paper was finally published, but Isadora's name appeared nowhere, not even in the acknowledgments. At the publication party, Alex claimed all her work as his own, while the academic community failed to question it. Later, when Alex visited her office, Isadora expected a proposal based on his hint about something important. Instead, he broke up with her, saying he needed someone more fun. The paper catapulted Alex's career. He got a prestigious job in Boston, traveled, taught, lectured, and even wrote a book, while Isadora remained stuck in her closet office, researching others' projects. This betrayal becomes the lens through which Isadora views her growing feelings for Cal. When she spots Alex pulling into campus in a blue Mustang, the same car Cal had borrowed, her suspicions explode. She concludes the similarities between Alex and Cal are too great to ignore and decides to end things despite all her documented feelings. The confrontation with Alex marks a turning point in Isadora's journey. For the first time, she stands up for herself, acknowledging that she allowed Alex to use her because she was afraid of being alone. She proudly declares that she's done hiding and underestimating herself, a moment of empowerment that simultaneously liberates and terrifies her. What makes this subplot so effective is how it illustrates the way past wounds color our perception of present relationships. Isadora's inability to distinguish between Alex's calculated manipulation and Cal's genuine interest shows how trauma creates false equivalencies, making us see danger where none exist. Her journey toward healing requires not just forming new relationships, but recontextualizing old ones, understanding that Alex's behavior reflected his character flaws, not her worthiness of love and respect. Isadora's carefully constructed new life faces two simultaneous crises, her discovery that Cal knows Alex and Marty suffering a heart attack. These events trigger her deepest fear, that opening herself to connection inevitably leads to pain. For 3 days, she isolates herself completely, calling in sick to work, avoiding showers, and ignoring life while subsisting on junk food. Though Cal continues texting her with sweet messages, she can't bring herself to respond. It takes Delilah picking her lock and delivering hard truths to shake Isadora from her spiral. If you want to have good friends, you have to be a good friend. This moment forces Isadora to confront the selfishness of her self-protection, how her attempt to avoid pain is actively hurting those who care about her. She realizes that by trying to prevent heartbreak, she's creating exactly the lonely existence she fears. Her visit to Marty in the hospital provides the wisdom she needs. When she apologizes for her absence, he simply says, "You're here now." He points out that her fear of getting hurt led her to push everyone away after seeing Alex, encouraging her to give people a chance rather than assuming the worst. The most profound insight comes when Isadora discovers Cal's manuscript with her name listed as co-author on the title page. Throughout the document, Cal has left sticky notes highlighting her contributions and giving her credit, the exact opposite of Alex's betrayal. One section catches her attention where Cal analyzes Doreen, clearly Isadora, and concludes that happiness, like human connection, is a choice. This challenges Isadora's fundamental belief that her unhappiness is solely due to external factors. After throwing her notebook in frustration, she has a revelation. She's deliberately isolated herself, afraid to feel anything for fear of feeling everything. She finally understands Marty's wisdom. If she's not willing to feel life's pain, she'll never experience its joy. Isadora's transformation culminates in two symbolic acts that represent her journey from self-sabotage to self-acceptance. For step 21, let go of grudges, she meticulously documents every resentment she's harbored throughout her life, against her parents for their constant pressure to achieve, childhood bullies who mocked her dedication to academics, Mia for betraying their friendship, and especially Alex for choosing career advancement over their relationship. Most significantly, she adds herself to the list, acknowledging how she made herself small, declined opportunities out of fear, and became her own worst enemy in the pursuit of happiness. In a cathartic, if slightly disastrous, gesture, she burns each grudge in her fireplace, watching as years of accumulated pain turn to ash. She starts with smaller grudges, the barista who always misspells her name, the colleague who took credit for her research, building up to the weightier ones. However, she forgets to open the damper, triggering the building's fire alarm and forcing an evacuation. Standing outside with her neighbors in the Chicago winter while firefighters handle the situation, she finds herself laughing genuinely for the first time in months. The chaos becomes a perfect metaphor for the messy but liberating process of letting go. Sometimes, creating a bit of havoc is necessary for real change. When she finally confronts Cal at his laboratory, surrounded by his research specimens, she admits that her happiest moments weren't the achievements she'd pursued so relentlessly, but the small moments they shared. Late-night conversations about quantum mechanics, impromptu dance parties in his kitchen, quiet mornings solving crossword puzzles together. She recognizes that while he can't make her happy, only she can do that, she wants him as her partner through everything: research failures, burnt dinners, fire alarms, and moments of joy. This nuanced understanding of happiness as a personal choice rather than something others provide represents Isadora's most profound growth. The novel concludes on Isadora's 31st birthday as she presents her findings to an enthusiastic audience at Chicago University. Her published paper, The Quantum Mechanics of Happiness, A Study in Human Choice Theory, with proper credit given to all collaborators, including Cal's contributions to the psychological aspects, has earned her both a promotion and her own research assistant. At her surprise birthday party, surrounded by friends in the same cafe where she first began her happiness experiment, Isadora realizes she's finally found true happiness. Not because everything is perfect, but because she's learned to embrace imperfection. The evening ends with Isadora sending a group text to her friends about the most important step to happiness. Step 32, choose to be happy, then get out of your own way. This final insight encapsulates the novel's central message. Happiness isn't something that happens to us, but something we actively pursue by removing our self-imposed barriers and accepting that the path to joy often includes detours, fire alarms, and unexpected discoveries along the way. At its heart, The Happy Life of Isadora Bentley is a meditation on the essential role of human connection in creating happiness. Through Isadora's journey, we see how isolation, even when self-imposed for protection, ultimately leads to suffering. The novel suggests that true happiness requires risk, the willingness to be vulnerable, to potentially experience pain, and to let others see our authentic selves. What makes this story particularly powerful is how it balances scientific methodology with emotional truth. Isadora's analytical approach to happiness isn't portrayed as wrong. In fact, her research ultimately validates many of Dr. Monroe's suggestions. The flaw isn't in her scientific mind, but in her assumption that she can study happiness without experiencing it, that she can understand connection without participating in it. The novel also offers a nuanced view of healing from past trauma. Isadora's journey doesn't involve forgetting or minimizing her painful experiences, but recontextualizing them. She learns to see her past not as a predictor of her future, but as a part of her story that doesn't determine its ending. Her symbolic burning of grudges represents not erasure, but integration, acknowledging hurt while choosing not to let it control her decisions. Perhaps most importantly, the book challenges the notion that happiness is a destination rather than a practice. Through Isadora's experiments, we see that happiness isn't achieved once and permanently secured, but cultivated through daily choices and habits. It's found in small moments, flying kites with someone who sees your authentic self, sharing a bench with an elderly man who values your company, or receiving a handmade journal from a child who considers you a friend. In the end, Isadora's greatest discovery isn't which of the 31 steps works best, but that happiness, like science, requires both methodology and wonder, the willingness to follow proven practices while remaining open to unexpected results. By choosing to participate in her own experiment rather than merely observing it, she transforms from researcher to pioneer, creating a life that's messy, unpredictable, and infinitely more fulfilling than she ever imagined possible.